Welcome to Worlds Apart. The great Polish writer Stanisław Jerzyliec, who lived to see both the First and the Second World War, remarked toward the end of his life that we should not expect too much from the end of the world. Given that death, famine, war and conquest, the four biblical horsemen of the apocalypse, are already riding atop of our daily news bulletins, hasn't the world, at least as we knew it, already ended? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Dmitry Trenin, research professor at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Mr. Trenin, it's always a great delight for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming to the studio.
Thank you, Oksana, for inviting me. Thank you.
Now, this month marks the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you just the other day published an article suggesting that for all the seeming similarities, the current confrontation between Russia and the West is a far cry from the U.S.-Soviet tensions. Why is that?
Well, there are several reasons for that. Certainly, you cannot step into the same river twice. And the Russian Federation, although it's just a new name for eternal Russia, as was the Soviet Union, it's still very different from the Soviet Union. It's different in its position in the world, most importantly. It's different in its national might. And it's different in the way that its adversary, the United States, then and now views or viewed Russia. Mm. So basically what I'm arguing is that in 1962, the United States could still afford a compromise with Russia. Well, this compromise was presented to the Western public as a win for the United States. In fact, it was not, but images matter, optics matters. Today, I can see no willingness on behalf of the United States to split the difference. And that's a cardinal difference between then and now.
Mm-hmm. You also point out in that article that the Soviet Union was perceived by Washington as an equal, whereas the current Western elites see Russia as a second or perhaps even third-tier country whose prowess, national prowess, rests only on nuclear weapons and energy sources. Now, putting the issue of hierarchy aside, nuclear weapons and energy sources, are they really so little in this day and age? What more do you need?
Well, I actually borrowed that from one of the pronouncements by President Biden. And he basically said, I pity the president of Russia because he can only rely on energy sources and nukes. With regard to energy sources or energy exports, the United States has been doing a great deal to suppress Russia's energy exports, primarily to Europe and to other countries that are in the U.S. orbit. With regard to nuclear, I think that the bet in Washington is that Russia will not use them. We're not living in 1962 again. Russia might use nukes on a tactical level, most probably in Ukraine in that sense. That's the way our, i.e. NATO, doctrine was structured, was designed in the days of the Cold War. When if you're losing a conventional battle, you use nukes and then you seek peace on acceptable terms. So you just think about your adversary the way you would have behaved yourself.
Mr. Trenin, the fact that the Americans would go to such great length, even strategizing about nukes and energy, shows that those are formidable assets. Is it just a nuisance when you consider them to be the only thing that the country can base its prowess on?
Well, you know, I'm not expressing my own views. I think that Russia has a lot to offer itself and something to offer to the world. And I think that Russia is better positioned than most countries around the world, or a vast majority of countries around the world, for example, facing the climate change, the climate crisis. So I think that Russia is far better positioned than a lot of people in the West mm-hmm. think it is. But I just took those those words out of the mouth of Mr. Biden.
Can I then ask you, do you think that such conclusion, is it based on authentic poli-sci analysis, or is it just their preferred version of reality, sort of?
Well, again, everyone lives in his or her preferred version of reality. And what's the truth today? You know, who knows?
Now, this is an interesting question because you recently gave another interview which made quite a splash in the Russian media, and you suggested that the biggest problem we now face is the absence of fear, that the Americans lost the sense of fear, and because of that, they can behave with arrogance. What can possibly disabuse them of that arrogance?
Well, reemergence of fear.
And how can you help them help themselves?
Well, look, fear is fundamental to deterrence. You would recall a phrase that was coined at the beginning of the Cold War, which basically I hesitate to say whether it was Churchill or somebody else, but it doesn't matter. The phrase itself is worth repeating, and that is that peace has become the sturdy child of fear. So we live in peace because we live in fear. That was the maxim during the days of the Cold War. Now we have returned to the days of, it's not a Cold War anymore. I call it hybrid war. People call it Cold War 2.0, whatever. But again, if you have an adversarial relationship with another major power, the only thing you can base peace upon is fear. Now, for the United States, Russia is not exactly a midget, but certainly not a peer. The Soviet Union was a peer in the military and political and ideological terms, not so much in economic terms. But the Russian Federation is just nuclear power and energy power. Basically, that's it from their point of view. And if you cannot and would not use nukes, because, again, who would want to commit suicide, people? And there's no ideology in the name of which you would have used in the old days nuclear weapons. And if that's the case, then you just, we, the United States, can press you and can suppress your energy exports and deter you from using nuclear by just pointing to the utter senselessness mm-hmm. of the use of nuclear. And then what do you do?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting on the issue of nuclear weapons, because I think you, in that interview, you directly suggested that the only way to sort of sober up our transatlantic comrades is to present a direct nuclear threat
Yes, I would not look. I need to...
Not to bluff about it,
I was not suggesting that Russia should attack the United States with nuclear weapons. What I said was that the idea that Russia can only use tactical nukes in a place like Ukraine, which is something very widely debated in the West, mm-hmm. Is wrong. And again, logically speaking, one way to deter the United States, or maybe the only way to deter the United States from supporting Ukraine to the level when that support can make a strategic difference for Russia, would be to strengthen deterrence. Now, how do you strengthen deterrence? You basically strengthen it by saying that, in certain circumstances, we will not be hitting at Ukraine, we'll be hitting elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And that should sober people up. So basically, the idea was not to suggest that Russia needs to, hit the United States with a nuke. The idea was to strengthen deterrence, the foundation of peace as we know it.
And it's interesting that most of the Western decision makers, when they make statements about Russia's possible use of nuclear weapons, they indeed focus on tactical strikes upon Ukraine. They never even conceive of Russia being able to reach their own homelands. Do you think that's a deflection on their part? Or do they honestly believe that given Russia's potentials, and those people in the know, they know of Russia's nuclear potential, they know that it can realistically reach those lands. Do you think they simply don't believe, or is it still a game, so to say?
I think that, as President Biden said just the other day, he regards Mr. Putin a rational person, a rational leader, right? And a rational leader would not commit suicide. But what was rational about America's and its allies' own defense posture during the Cold War was, if you are losing conventionally, strike them with nuclear arms at the tactical level, and that ends the conflict on the terms that you can accept. I think that a lot of people in the West watching the Ukraine crisis believe that Russia is almost with its back to the wall. And in that situation, the only way out for Russia, if it doesn't want to be utterly defeated in conventional terms, would be to resort to nuclear arms. Now, since they are rational, i.e. Russians are rational, then they will use those weapons on the battlefield, i.e. in Ukraine. And I'm someone who spent three decades of my life trying to help prevent a collision between Russia and the United States and the West. I see my mission as a failure, a complete failure.
Well, Mr. Trenin, as I told you before we began recording this conversation, the history doesn't stop here. And this administration, hopefully, is not the last administration in the United States,
It may not be the worst administration. Who knows what happens
Can I actually ask you about this issue of rationality or irrationality? Because we know from history that behaving irrationally or erratically in politics actually has its own benefits, because I think that widens a scope of your actions, and it indeed transfers the responsibility for sanity onto your opponent. So when considering the American actions, rather than perceiving them as an act of arrogance, couldn't that also be an act of despair, sort of a last-ditch or make-or-break attempt to preserve the valued but quickly dissipating hegemony?
I think that the United States is certainly fighting a battle for it's not a last stand, but it's certainly a battle to preserve its hegemony. And the United States has just, the United States elites have gotten themselves married to the notion of being the world hegemon. And impossible for them, I think, to imagine a world that's not led by the United States. The most recent national security strategy released by the Biden administration basically says that there's no other country in the world that's equipped, as the United States is, to lead the world. And the idea is to shape the world order according to the values and interests of the United States of America. That's the idea, and they're being serious about that. Desperate? I wouldn't think that they're desperate, but they're certainly serious about that. They may not have a good strategy. They may not have a well thought through strategy how to deal with that. So they strategize as they move forward, and that carries its own risks. But that's where we are.
Well, it not only carries its own risks, but already manifests multiple negative consequences, including for their own society. But let's discuss them after a short break. We'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dmitry Trenin, research professor at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Mr. Trenin, I began our conversation by quoting Stanislav Yerzhelets, a Polish writer who was born in what is now Western Ukraine in Lviv. And in his autobiography, he's quite frank that in order to escape from a Nazi labor camp in 1943, he had to kill his Nazi guard who had taken him out to dig a grave. I rarely get a chance to recite poetry on this program, so please indulge me. He wrote that he who had dug his own grave looks attentively at the grave digger's work, but not pedantically, for this one digs a grave not for himself. And I'm sure you can intuit my question already. Given this declared American intention to not just undermine, but perhaps even ruin Russia, don't you think that the Americans themselves could be digging, if not a grave, then a trench for themselves?
Well, first of all, I don't think that most serious Americans would agree with your characterization of them digging a grave for Russia.
Really not?
No, they don't. Well, you know, I still stay in touch with my colleagues and professional partners in the United States. And
well, obviously, they have only good intentions, which we all know leads where, right?
Yes, right. And this is precisely the issue. They asked me to explain my notion that the war in Ukraine is of existential importance for Russia. And they didn't understand what I meant by existential. And they said that they only wanted Russia out of Ukraine, and that's all. They didn't want
And they want themselves or their military equipment in Ukraine, and that's all, too,
no, but
right?
That they would say that this is only a matter between them and Kiev, and that's basically it. I tried to show them what would happen should any Russian leader just accept their terms. And, you know, after that, they didn't raise the question again. So it is existential for Russia. The problem is that, you know, a lot of people deal only in formal logic in the United States. You went across the border, you need to be pushed back across your border and maybe pay the indemnity, punish the guilty ones, and then learn to live with the rest of the world based on the rules that, you know, the more advanced portion of humanity has written for you. Basically, that's the idea. They will not say there's nothing anti-Russian about that. There's nothing. Well, they do not. At least in public debate, they would not appreciate the consequences of the actions that they demand.
I think one of the peculiar sides of this confrontation is that the Americans are no longer insulated from the effects of their own foreign policy. And by picking up a fight with Russia, they have produced a lot of negative consequences, economic, political, social consequences for their own society and for the societies of their closest allies. So they are already feeling the pinch, as they like to say. Do you think that impact on their society is monumental or persuasive enough to, if not change the course of their actions, then at least change something within the American society?
Well, as I see it, nothing of the kind, nothing of the sort. What they see is Europe being hit by the disruption of energy supplies to Europe from Russia, which they blame on Russia and solely on Russia. Europe is becoming deindustrialized. They will not publicly say that, but they are the beneficiaries of the process. The United States is winning back its industrial power by attracting European businesses, European companies, European manufacturing to the United States. And that is a boon for them. Now, Europe may become poorer, Europe may become less advanced, but Europe will not seek to separate geopolitically and militarily from the United States. Indeed, the opposite is happening. Europe has never been as closely allied with the United States as it is today. So, no, I don't think that they feel the pinch. The Europeans feel the pinch. But not the Americans. Americans are the beneficiaries of the war so far. And, of course, all these weapons that are being sent to Ukraine, all these weapons that are destroyed in Ukraine, these things mean more orders for American defense companies, and that is another good
thing. But that also means higher gas prices at the pump and more and more people. I mean, look at Biden's approval ratings. I know that there are many ways of influencing electoral politics, so to say, but still, I mean, the conservative base has never been as fired and as irritated, if not to use some stronger words, than it is today.
Well, we'll see what happens at the polls. We'll see what happens in November. We'll see what happens 2 years from now. We think big changes are more likely than not in the United States at some point, maybe not 2024, but certainly through the end of this decade, there will have to be some changes in the U.S. political class, and that means the changes in U.S. foreign policy also. But I think that the idea of America's hegemony, America's global dominance, is something that continues to unite the American elite across the aisle. And I see no departure from that, unless there is some sort of an upheaval within the United States, some sort of really deep soul-searching, but that can only come after some major defeat of the United States at home. I don't think that they will be defeated anywhere abroad, but domestically there may be some an upheaval that will send them thinking.
You seem to subscribe to this popular idea within the American establishment that a major upheaval or a major threat can only come to the United States from within the United States rather than from the outside. But if you look at the behavior of many of the American allies, including some of the oil-producing Arab countries, for example, Saudi Arabia, and I'm not even mentioning countries like China, India, South Africa, many of the Latin American countries, they are not taking sides, but they are clearly not excited about the American hegemony because, for very pragmatic reasons, subscribing to anyone's hegemony at this point of time, when you need sovereignty as a means of making decisions, it's not just an abstract construction, but it's a way of functioning in an unpredictable world. They don't seem to be buying that concept anymore. Do you think hegemony is sustainable in the world today, not in the mind of American elites, but within the global community?
Well, within part of the global community, yes. That part of the community will include Europe. That part of the community will include other American allies in what they call the Indo-Pacific region and some other nations. With regard to sovereignty, it's a good thing to have, but it's extremely expensive. Now, if you want to be sovereign, you have to brace for very serious pressure. And if you resist that pressure, you're likely to pay at the cost.
But if you take the Russian route, because I think the Russians are very sort of feisty in demonstrating that we want our sovereignty, but many countries, I think, far smarter. They have their own independent decision-making, but without irritating the Americans too much.
Well, each nation has its national character, in my view. Russia's just defies, cannot accept, even notionally, even for a period of time, subservience or, you know, a position of a follower to the hegemon. Other countries find that to be far more, then be more flexible about it. India, for example, it regards itself as a sovereign nation that takes sovereign decisions, but what they care about most is chances for development. Chances for development can only be realized if India is growing economically. That means that they have a huge stake in being a growing part of the U.S.-led economic system, global economic system. They cannot afford being on the wrong side of the United States. Other countries, such as China, have advanced very far, and they are considered to be a challenger to the United States. They still want to to make sure that this collision does not come too early, that they still continue to get the benefits from their exposure to the American market. And it is the United States that takes the lead in escalating, let's say, trade and economic sanctions aimed at China. Now, Russia is not a merchant country. It's a country, essentially, it's a country of warriors. It's a country of warriors, thinkers. We're not a nation of shopkeepers, as Napoleon said of Britain.
I guess this is the last question I have time to ask you, but I think Russia is also a country of peacemakers, and it's fascinating for me to observe all this mystical signaling between Putin and Biden, because they throw in the references to Bible here and there, and in one of his latest speeches, Putin again quoted Jesus' Sermon on the Mountain, which also includes a couple of beatitudes, including the one that blessed are the peacemakers because they will be called sons of God. I wonder how much this... Is this all rhetoric as far as you are concerned, or do you think it has more to it, at least for the Russian elites? Do they see that this battle as a messianic, perhaps, one, or as something that touches upon more than just geopolitics?
Well, the Russian elite is not homogeneous. And much of the Russian elite, I think, regret the disruption of relations with the West, where their assets are or were, and whether some of their second homes or first homes were or are. I'm also intrigued by the several dozen deputies of the Duma who did not show up to vote for the inclusion of four new regions into the Russian Federation. That is very interesting. So the elites are very, they have very different views on things. What is interesting, though, is that for the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the more energetic, the more active part of the elite are those who define themselves as patriots, those who think in terms of not only geopolitical things, but, in terms of the national interest and in the very, very fundamental sense of the word. Now you have a divided Russian nation. We have to collect the stones that were thrown, thrown far and wide in the days of Gorbachev and Yeltsin. We need to work for a greater Russia that Mr. Putin mentioned in his St. George's speech. Mm-hmm. That is interesting, but who will prevail in the end is still, to me at least, is still a question mark. I have my own views and I have my own preferences, but as an analyst, I'm sitting and looking at that with a lot of interest, but also with a lot of concern.
Well, Mr. Trenin, I really hope that in a while we can discuss here whether your projections or theories worked out, but for the time being, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure.
Thank you, Oksana. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.